accession number 28750, reel 17.
Laurie Manton, reel 17.
Yeah, they had a thing where Musgrave Park Military Hospital, which was a multi-storey building, reasonably flimsily built, you know, it was a girder construction with the walls then sat into it. And the IRA had smuggled a big bobbin below, which blew it up and, you know, destroyed a huge chunk of the building and killed a number of nurses and other medical personnel. And they thought it'd be a good idea to get Soldier out there to report it and to get something quickly in. So it was myself and a photographer up to Luton on the plane, whizzed round there and, you know, asked to interview the sort of survivors and such like. Very difficult story to write.
What was difficult about it?
Well, the fact that these people had survived it. But they were still there, and they were still at risk. And if you start pinpointing people as having, you know, the IRA didn't kill me, they'd be a marked person, because the IRA would then put them on their specially wanted list to eliminate.
So you had to really protect them, did you, in your... article by not
unusually for only you know the second time, although that was the first time, the copy had to be sent off to be looked at by headquarters Northern Ireland just to see if there are any sensitivities before it could go out. But normally there was nothing like that. You just write your story and it's it goes in, and it's quite an art to do that. In terms of inaccuracies, I think in 10 years I made two errors in what I reported. One was the first week and one was an understandable error in any case. But they had in one particular site, they had what used to be an old mill, so it was a huge factory building. And I won't say the name of the mill. They're often in mills, but it was, I suppose, the equivalent of 8 stories high building, but it would have just 2 floors because they had all the big machinery and all the rest of it in there. But it was then converted into living accommodation for the troops. Pretty Spartan, to say the least. And they go out on patrol from there around the village, and it was very unusual because it was a dry village, and had been because the factory owners had created the village, and so there were no pubs, which is quite something in Northern Ireland, which is very unusual. But there was I was wandering up to the Neffy one night, and there was a little Neffy, and these little shops used to be run. It's a dreadful thing that they called them. It was choggy shops. And they were run by Indians or Asians who would be open all hours and sell sweets, cigarettes, soft drinks, crisps and all the rest of them. They're known as chuggy shops. And in the late 90s, the Naffy decided it wanted to put all these people out of business, so insisted that it had the shops. And then would only open during normal daytime hours, and therefore there's, you know, poor service. But they're traditionally known, you know, as the army used to call them, even in Victorian times, choggy shops. But as I say, I was on my way there when I heard this big explosion. And I walked in this little shop into the restaurant area. and everyone was on the floor. So I thought, well, I better get myself on the floor. And someone said, get down. Mortar attack. And it was a huge explosion. It really shook the building. And there was a long time of alert. And they said, no, it was the police station that was hit. But evidently the terrorists had come down. They intended to mortar the army base. But security was so tight, they couldn't get near enough for their mortars to bomb it. And what they do is they get an old van and they put these big mortars packed full of explosive charge inside, set a timer, and they would have removed the roof of the van. So these big things go out and then go up in the end, land and go boom. So they did the police station. So we went out with the patrol at first light and walked through what had been the security fence of the police station, which had gone. There was just a big chunk of it missing. And all the policemen's cars were actually covered in rubble and smashed, and a lot of the, it was glass everywhere. So it had been a big, a real big bang. So I'd heard a mortar go off, I heard them explode, thinking that they were close by, so loud was it. And then been in to see the damage that was done. So we went around there, took some photographs and such like. And they said, right, we're sending a patrol up to where the van is that fired the mortars. And that was in the middle of a estate full of families. And they were really unimpressed. Because they'd had a bomb in the area some months before. It was a council estate. The council had come in and renewed all the roofs, put the tiles back on and done the windows. And when this thing went off, it took all the tiles off the roofs of people's houses and blew their windows in. That's just the firing point, not the landing point. And it's very difficult to do anything against that type of operation. Many of my patrols, of course, I'd said were done on foot. And if I take West Belfast, which is my other main area of operation, that's a strong Republican area. And you go out with the patrols there, and they would endure a certain amount of abuse or stone throwing and things like this. And it was quite interesting because they used to get these coffee jars, fill them full of nails and explosive and a detonator. And the patrol would be walking along, and the kids used to just throw them over the wall. They'd hit the ground and go off, and they'd be quite strong enough not only to shred you all with nails, but if it landed really close, it could blow your leg off. And I didn't endure anything like that, but I used to go out and there'd be rocks coming down and such like, or a big crowd gathering. And I used to think, God, imagine what it was like in the 70s, where they used to have the film on the telly of the soldiers all behind their protective shields being stoned by hundreds of people. Mm-hmm. But because you were with the patrol, then you were marked out. But again, it was wearing the cameras and carrying notebooks and such like. But it was a thing that the ordinary journalists wouldn't have. Because like in Bosnia, we wore uniform and went out with the troops, then the ordinary journalists couldn't. Here you got such access into the bases and on the patrols, which is far above what people would ordinarily get. But it's quite interesting because if you cover it, as I did from 91 till 97 was my last visit, by the very fact that you're staying in security force bases, it means you can't go out to the pub every evening. Because if you come out of a RUC police station where you're staying and walk out, anyone could see you and follow you and then, you know, assassinate you, if you like. And it wasn't until my very last time that I went there that I went with a photographer who came from Belfast, and he arranged to meet his school friend, that I was taken out to a safe area to have a drink in a pub and a, you know, steak and chips. But it was interesting because it was a very long pub, like long and thin, about 100 yards long, packed with tables. We sat right down the far end. It was the time of the Irish TT motorcycle races, which is the big sport over there every year. And a guy came down from the bar and said, "What do you want?" And the other two spoke in strong Belfast accents, you know, a pint of beer. And I said, "I'd like a Diet Coke, please." And the whole place went quiet. And I was petrified. And they're all looking at me like this, as if I'm some stranger. But because I was out with, you know, people who had the right accents. But, you know, on patrol, you couldn't even go in a shop in the middle of summer and as you pass by it to buy an ice cream or a cold drink. So all I saw was what the soldiers saw in all those times that I went there.
Yes, it seems from what you're saying and from your past experience as well that this really was far more dangerous or, you know, and restricted for you, and yet, you know, some of these other places sound so very dangerous.
Yeah, I have to say it got quite wearing towards the end, and I remember suddenly decided I'd like to become more creative and leave soldier and perhaps get an editorship of a magazine, because over 1 week I went out to Northern Ireland. We went down to visit some of these security towers on the border. We flew in a RAF helicopter, old Wessex helicopter. In fact, we did the first flight in a Puma helicopter. And at that time, they decided to fly it at Heathrow height. So this thing's beetling across the countryside. And bear in mind, there's no seats in the helicopters and things like this. You just stood in there. And they came across a farmhouse and then had to sort of almost turn it on its head, this helicopter. And, you know, you saw the chimneys go by each side. And I thought, oh, that's one of my nine lives used up. And I went out a couple of days later in this old Wessex helicopter, and they have a big tail wheel that comes out the back. And we came into land, and you had to just go over the barbed wire onto this hilltop security base area and land inside so people could get off, and then you took off again. I was looking out the window as we're just coming into land, and the welcoming committee, I saw them all run away. I thought, something's not right here. And we landed, and someone rushed over and stopped the helicopter. And as it had come in, its tail wheel caught the barbed wire, which was stretching out behind it. Now, if we'd gone on a bit, it would have stopped us, and then we would have toppled and crashed down the mountainside, and I thought, oh, I don't like that. And still the same week, I came back and went to see the Army's new Land Rover in Solihull at the Land Rover factory. And their chief test driver took us over the knife edge, where you go up a big knife edge slope and then down the other side. When we got almost to the top, he nearly rolled it off the edge, and it was only the fact that the photographer with me jumped across to the other side to distribute the weight more evenly that prevented us from rolling down, you know, 70 or 80 feet of a very steep slope when I thought, you know, I've had enough of this.
You say nine lives.
Yeah, I lose three in a week is a bit worrying, but that, yeah, that's a separate...
Did you see the effect of this on the troops? You know, I was thinking of the young men going out and having to put up with all that abuse. Is that, does that have a particular effect, do you think, having to cope with that? And I suppose they couldn't really respond.
No, they can't.
Did it do something to them?
I think a lot of them are quite badly affected by it. And so I went to one security force base where there'd been an incident. Now the IRA had got a notice that next to the railway line was this watchtower on the edge of the base, which was manned by a chap who looked out from there and had a machine gun and binoculars and all the rest of it. So what they did down the track, they put railway wheels on a Ford Transit van. You know, they took the proper wheels off, took the tyres off, lifted it onto the railway track, set it going at sort of 10 miles an hour, and this van just rode the rails, but it was packed full of explosives. And when it got level with the this watchtower, they blew it up, which toppled the tower, and the young lad was killed. And I'd arrived a couple of days later, and the officer in charge said, well, it's quite interesting. We've been doing a bit of counselling with the chap's friends who are very upset about it. Come and speak to them about it. And I thought, oh, I've been here before. That's a pretty dumb idea to do that. But I chatted with them, and they'd managed to chat it out. It was, if you like, the early stages of counselling in a way, but not officially done, where they discuss what they'd seen and how they felt and all the rest of it. And it was the early days of, you know, seeing how people were affected. I spoke to one chap and I said, he was your best friend, wasn't he? Yeah. Well, tell me what happened. Well, he'd blown up, hit the ground. We went in there, opened the door, picked him up, and his helmet had come off. And when we picked him up, we realised his brain was still in his helmet. So his head was empty. Yeah. I suppose with the force of the blast. And he was, you know, still very upset, but not as upset as he might have been. I should think it would cause a lot of long-term damage to these people, those that have really been involved in some horrendous things. I just think the mental damage would stay with them for a very long time. But I thought, oh, that's, you know, I could do without that sort of interview, if you like. Because I'd had one years previously in Germany as a side, where someone had been in a Scimitar fighting vehicle, which has a turret and a long gun barrel, and the gun barrel caught on a tree when it was going through the woods, stopped the vehicle dead, and the commander who stood in the turret, his head just shot down and it killed him instantly when he hit the armour of the sort of light tank. And I was taken off with the rest of the crew and this officer to a cafe in Germany, and he said to him, well, tell Laurie what it was like having so and so killed. And this must have been 2 hours before I arrived, and there was stony silence. So we just ate a bratwurst and chips and had a Coke, and I said, you know, let's go back now. And I thought that was pretty foolhardy of this chap, but it, you know, these things do crop up, And I can remember my most terrible occasion in Germany was when I was asked to visit a particular unit. They said, you know, they've suffered lots of casualties and things like this, and we got some people for you to talk to. And I was shown through this door shut behind me, and I'm in this big room which has like an audience sat in chairs facing me. And the chap that took me in there said, that's Mr. and Mrs. So-and-so, their son was murdered by the IRA and they're still badly affected by it. So-and-so here, his mind has gone because he was terrorised by the IRA who threatened to kill him. And this guy, when he used to walk home from doing his part-time duties, you know, someone from the IRA would drive slowly along behind him with an open window, just saying, bang, bang, you're dead, you're next. And then when he got a couple of live bullets through the post in an envelope, with a note saying the others have got your name on, you know, you broke mentally. And they said, oh, and there's so-and-so here, and went, and there's a guy lying on a hospital trolley with no legs, an eye missing, and I think half an arm missing as well. And so I had to say, just go, well, what happened to you? And he said, I left work at the factory. They'd obviously realised what I did part-time, put a bomb under the driver's seat, and I was just going down the, got about half a mile and it blew up. And he said, there's a big explosion. And he said, my car was on fire. And he said, even though he said, I realised I'd lost an arm, I managed to clamber over onto the back seat, got out the back window, and as I got going out the back window, my legs dropped off because they were just held by the sort of skin, so he left the legs behind. But he says, I survived. He says, my wife's very upset, as you can imagine, but I'm not going to let them beat me. And that traumatised me because there were loads of these people, you know, the grieving couple for their son. And I had absolutely no warning that such a thing was going to take place. And I was pretty unimpressed about it, to say the least. Because having been presented with that situation, and these people brought in from hospitals and elsewhere, there's no way I could turn on my heels and say, no, I'm not prepared to do it. So I had to do the interviews, and I wrote a story. And I did the bit with the guy. He gave me a full description, you know, like a blow-by-blow account of being blown up and losing his legs and such like. And that one I sent up to be checked. And they cut a lot of that out. But they left the foolish circumstances of the guy being blown up in the car. They just removed his name, even though they wanted his name to be known, because he was saying, they didn't get me. Well, they visit him as a cripple and kill him, as they felt he was saying that thing. So although I wasn't being shot or blown up or what have you, I was close to it. But it's when you start meeting people like that, it all has an effect on, you know, the way you view the operation out there.
Yes, it's interesting. It links up with what you were saying much earlier, that it didn't disturb you to photograph dead bodies, but it was the injured, you know, and the maimed that were...
Yeah, the people screaming is the is the affecting thing. If they're dead, dead and, you know, they're not there anymore.
And it indicates, doesn't it, there can be trauma for the interviewer, as well as the people who've, you know, actually experienced these things.
Well, it's interesting because there was a period that the IRA would capture people, fill their cars, you know, members of the public, fill their cars with explosive, tie them to their car seats, and say, drive your car in there, and when you get inside the gates, stop the car, and they'll come to you, and leave it at that. And what they actually did was wait till the car went in there, and press the button, and this member of the public and all the soldiers would be killed by this massive bomb, because it was in the protective area. It was the only way they could get in. And after a while, you know, it was horrendous for the people who were strapped in the vehicles, because they were going to die, whatever. And because they were being delivered by someone else, they were known as proxy bombs. And I can remember arriving in a vehicle with a civilian dressed escort, with a photographer, and just as we're going in through the gates, there was the proxy bomb alert, a special siren, which meant they thought the car inside was going to blow up. So our two military escorts were straight out of their doors and running. My photographer, like an idiot, is rummaging for his camera to get a photo, but it would have been the last thing he'd ever seen. And I got well outside the car before I realised I hadn't even undone my seatbelt. I'd taken it to its maximum stretch, like a cartoon character trying to run away from this. In the event, it turned out it wasn't. But I can tell you that is really shaking, because, you know, when you're operating with the military, then you do see the photographs and read the reports of what actually happens in one of those incidents. So I thought, God damn, I've really had enough of it.
End of Veal 17, Laurie Manton.